you will recall that Honourable had then been with the European Union when we were on the other side. And we said we understood the issues in Europe itself, but our concern was that they were, the trade was busy being reduced, not simply because we were diversifying markets, but also trying to maintain trade with Europe. And they raised a very interesting thing. You will recall that some countries are very concerned with South Africa terminating bits, you know, in Europe. And this was raised with us in particular. And I raised this issue, and the European president pointed out that they had a very different view, that it was important for them to maintain the European Union as a group. And that very often people with bilateral engagements with other countries tend to create the impression of a preferred status for their country. But when they are sitting in the European Union, those very same countries, the very same ones, are the ones that block South Africa having open access. So we must, I think, avoid having our rose-coloured spectacles on when it comes to hardcore issues like trade. Because it's amazing how things become misty when you've got your rose-coloured spectacles on. We are somewhat naive in that regard, and we do need to be firmer on that front. But I just thought I could share that with you because it cuts across our parties, and that they did also welcome the idea that South Africa was one of the few countries who, when they terminated an agreement, they still protected the investment for a further 15 years. And these are things that you don't read about publicly. All right, that was just to make you aware of some of the issues that are being discussed, among other issues such as the aid. We, the apologies, Mr. Hermans?
Chairperson, we have the signing apology from us. Also, we have an apology from Mr. Hilvers, who will be arriving late because he has to start at the EPC this morning. And those are the only apologies I have received for now.
And just to remind you, did you send that letter off then? I think we did to Honourable Ambrosie. It'll also be advisable, although we know that there is a medical issue involved, for us to ascertain his health in the same way that we ascertain the health and the progress of other members. I did confer briefly with the Honourable Amanda Merva, who assured me she is on the sort of road to recovery now, and she hopes to join us either Friday or at the next meeting thereafter. And I think we would welcome her return to the committee. That's all I can offer at this stage on the apologies. I think we are all here otherwise. I'm looking to cope, and I think I saw Mr. McIntosh, Honourable McIntosh. Oh, yes, there we are. Yes. Okay. So we can get someone to propose adoption of the agenda.
All right.
Honourable James, seconded by Honourable Kwabasa.
Right. And then we can immediately
go towards the BBBEE amendment bill, and you will recall we're working now on the clause by clause. I think that's where we are. I just want to confer with Chair of the Subcommittee, the Honourable Kadebi.
Thank you, Chair. On the issue of the Trump impact, the important days, well, we're supposed to have it today. Yeah. Friday.
Friday? I don't think that extension has ever been given. It's not our policy to allow people that much elasticity when they respond. No, I know that, but it's just not our policy. It's like saying black is white is black. It's not our policy. So exactly when does it happen? 2012, is to remind everyone brackets are omissions, the underlining indicates insertions. And the bill, the purpose of the bill then is to amend the Bill-Based BEE Act 2003 so as to insert certain definitions and to amend others. To clarify interpretation, to provide for the remuneration of council members, to promote compliance by organs of state, etc. Until we end with to provide for offences and penalties and to provide for matters connected therewith. Be it enacted by the Parliament of the Republic of South Africa as follows. Amendment of Section 1 of Act 53, 2003, Clause 1. That goes over two or three lines until you come to line 7, 6 and 7 by the insertion before the definition of black people of the following definitions. The BBB initiative means any transaction, comma, practice, scheme or other initiative which affects compliance with this act or any other law promoting broad-based black economic empowerment. We then have the BBB verification professionals, unchanged. Is there a problem, Chair, of the subcommittee, Honourable Debbie? And then we go to the BBB verification of professional regulator, and there are changes there. That means South African National Accreditation System established by the Accreditation for Conformity Assessment. Yeah, okay. That's why I saw your puzzle just now, okay, puzzle on your face. Members, we'll start again at the end of line 6 or 7 rather. I have the old amendments in front of me, but they are fresh amendments, which is triple B, that's why I was reading the actual code, it's triple B double E 2013 1D at the top. Very, all right, and you'll be working with the main bill, of course, which is 2013/1. All right, triple B, double E verification professional means. Any means a person. Okay, are we all on the same page? Who performs any work in connection with the rating, with rating the status of enterprises in terms of broad-based black economic empowerment, compliance on the authority of or for a rating agency accredited by the BBBEE verification professional regulator. Right. Then we go on to BBBEE verification professional. And that is also insertions, amendments, means a body appointed by the Minister for the accreditation of rating agencies or the authorization BBBEE verification professionals. And then we moved to section 2 on page. Just before we do that, I noticed that there were other members from DCI here besides when we called on the Christmas CPOC order, and welcomed him, but we should also welcome the Chief Director of the BEE, Ms. Mfatshwa, Professor E. Lix. He doesn't look, not yet, right. We then have Mr. L. Stetter, who's the Director, BPD, right. Advocate J. Stridham, Legal Advisor to DTI. And then Advocate H. Smuts, State Law Advisor and Legal Services to Parliament, Advocate Swartz. Okay, thank you. Now, we've been through Section 1, okay? Clause 1, Section 1. Do we agree? We're not adopting the bill yet, you know, just want people to be, but we agree on this clause. Right? Yeah, but we now have to agree here in committee. Yes, fine. Honourable James?
Just to be clear, we're agreeing to Section
1. Section 1. Okay, Section 1. Not Section 2. We haven't done Section 2 yet.
That's fine. Thanks.
Madam Chair, just a question of clarity. So I understand that we're dealing with Section 1A at the moment.
Now we move across to 2. Are we all on the same page now? On page 3. On page 3. Okay. On page 3, from line 3, to omit Africans, coloured and Indians, and to substitute, I'm all forgetting that line, and to substitute Africans, sorry, persons classified as African, coloured, Indian, or Chinese under apartheid laws. It's a very specific reference to the Chinese as to when it applies, and I think that that is the important issue there. And then we, Honourable James.
Madam Chair, I mean, I was part of the subcommittee that arrived at this, but I am still very nervous about it. And let me just say that what we need to do is define who's eligible as beneficiary for BBEE without defining, without government defining rights. That's the problem. And this, so I have no difficulties with B, A and B as it is on page 3. But I wonder if we could pop this issue because it requires, I think, further discussion. Because just to say that, and I haven't formulated it properly, what I think we should say there under B is by substitution for the definition of black people of the following definition, because what you want to do is define people who are eligible persons for BBBEE. And you want to do that on the basis of a definition of advantage as a result of apartheid. I think it's really dangerous.
Disadvantage or advantage?
Disadvantage. Under apartheid.
Yeah.
All right. But I mean, I haven't come up with a proper formulation here as we are, and I'm asking that we pop this issue and return to it. That is my request.
All right. It's early in the day, we'll flag it. Noting, of course, that there was a broad agreement in the subcommittee, but we're now at the next stage, and we're parking this one for a moment. Well, not for a moment, but yes, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I have raised my concern, and I've been partially reassured by the legal advice from Mr. Smuts, but I mean, there were a very specific law to do with race in South Africa. It was called the Population Registration Act. That defined all race and so on. And I'm just concerned that we should, if we're going to have this in, and I share Honourable James's concerns about it, is that the only law under which people were classified, because that's the critical word, was the Population Registration Act. So why not say, as classified under the Population Registration Act, Act so-and-so of 1951, I think, or 53. Then it's resolved. because apartheid laws is a kind of catch-all, Madam Chair. So I just want to raise that for the purposes of adjoining Ms. Honourable James.
Now, well, look, I do feel your Honourable colleague is not entirely in agreement. So, as we've already agreed, we're parking the issue for the moment. Now, let's get that clear. You're not saying yes. There is a difference of opinion. We're parking it. We're coming back to it. And no more clarifications. Just to come back to this now myself, we then come to your third amendment. Are we not on the third amendment?
No, I have made an amendment in the working group, which was in line 5.
But we're not on line 5.
Yes, we are.
We're on line 3.
Oh, I thought we'd move to...
No, that's why I'm saying that we've got to really listen. On page 3, in line 13, line 13, after broad-based, to insert black. Do we see that?
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Madam Chair, sorry, I'm on page 6, page 5, 6, 7. I'm not on page 13.
But we're on page...
I mean, sorry, line, sorry.
What line are you
on? I'm on, look, forget about these pages. I'm interested in the bill.
No, but
I'm on page 3 of the bill, and I'm on line 7 in subclause, open brackets, little b, close brackets, which is at the top of page 3 of the bill. We're all on the same line, Madam Chair.
You're on page 3. We're also on page 3.
Okay.
You now want to go to line 7.
Line 5, okay, line 5, which says black people, etc.
I see this here in my writing, it says cope.
Correct.
Before 1994. Is this what you wish to say?
That's what I wish to move as an amendment, Madam Chair.
All right, let's just, hold. And let's just see now where we are here.
Madam Chair,
wait just a minute. Honourable McIntosh, I've just asked for your, just a bit of caution there, the orange light. Page 3. Now, we are with you. I hope everyone is there. This did come up. It did come up at the last session. And we said we deal with it now. And we better deal with it. So, we're either going to flag it to come back, and that's the second time we're flagging it, or we're going to deal with it. So you've got to be there, and it said before 1994, but that issue may have been dealt with, Honourable McIntosh, so I'll now allow you to speak.
Madam Chair, I think I've made my case. I argued in a document which the Secretary kindly distributed. I don't know if he's distributing another document by the richest man in Africa, the Nigerian, Don Gwate. Which I did ask him to do, my concern, and here is a technical question, is whether before 1994 should be after birth or after descent. My own view is after birth, because I believe that people who are 20, turn 20 in 2014, should not have the burden of our history dragged around with them. I think they should be free, because they're born free. And not only that, it means somebody who turns 21 in 2014 has technically 40 years to benefit, if there is a benefit from this bill, unless, of course, it's Mr. Some of our members feel we could revise this bill in 10 years' time when everybody's very rich. But, Madam Chair, my concern is that I feel strongly about this amendment. I'm quite happy to park it, but I will move it because I think the committee's got to make a decision about whether it believes they're born frees or they're not born frees.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't really think it's an issue about born frees, but what we will do, because the more you refer to it, the more I recall all your arguments. And I would suggest that we allow members to refresh their own minds and come back to it. We will come back to it. Is that clear? Honourable McIntosh?
Madam, my last thing, I just want to mention that document that was published, on Politics Web on the web page.
Yeah, we're aware of
it. I just want members to understand my reference to the Dhaka trade in that document. Was it mustn't be construed as my being in favour of the Dhaka trade. I'm not. But I just felt it was an interesting illustration of the energy and entrepreneurial ability of a certain element of our family. I mean, of our
family.
Of our South African family.
No. We're really knocking down that street. Now, can we leave? I've agreed that we are parking this issue, and you can see where it led. Kind of self-indictment. Now, page three. But we are parking, Honourable McIntosh. You have not been overlooked.
Thank you, Chair.
On page three. Well, no, we will just do line three for the moment. Not line three. Well, it is. It's page three, line 13. And look at what it is here, 10, 11, 12. 13 is actually intercedes by the substitution for the definition of broad-based to insert black. We've done that. Economic empowerment of the following definition. Now, we need to first look at A. And we said we're copying A. We are then, when we came to B, it is related to A, so we have to leave that. We now come to C. I hope members see what we've done doing. So we're going to C now by the substitution. We agree to that, and we say broad-based black economic empowerment. Still on page 3, line 29. On line 29, we talk about to omit including the promotion of local content procurement. Line 29. To omit including. Right, okay. So it would read then, preferential procurement from enterprises that are owned or managed by black people. There was a DA proposal here at our last meeting, delete managed by black people. I'm looking at the DA. Yes, Honourable James.
Just to remind the committee that what the current formulation does by restricting the ownership or management or both, it creates in law a definition of what black empowerment is without referring to employment equity or to the other element of the scorecard. So we could have a situation where a firm is owned by a black person, managed by a black person, but the entire stock consists of white males, just to illustrate the problem. Therefore, what the recommendation is that they are owned or managed by black people is replaced by that are black empowerment by virtue of the application of the scorecard. Because what's required is an alignment between this and the scorecard that's coming. Otherwise, in law, we will say that black empowerment means black owned or black managed only. And that's, I think, is a serious problem.
Currently, it says that are owned or managed by black people. Your proposal is that the sentence would read?
That it would read, black empowered enterprises
that are
by virtue of the application of the scorecard.
You must look at the sentence before, the overriding one C, in which, remember, because it falls under C. You see that there, don't you?
Yes.
In which we say, and people living in rural areas, et cetera, that include, but are not limited to. Not limited to. So you're trying to point out that this is broader than we think. It's not limited to those managed by black people. Not limited to this. It should be not limited to, and you say, X, Y, Z. You see, I'm just seeing that the two don't go together. If you read C, not limited to, and you read your definition with it, it's not limited to. Now, if you carry on with your proposal, and that's where you begin to have a challenge.
What?
Well, let me leave it with you there. That's what I'm saying. You know, I hear what you wish to say, but I don't think you've factored in the proviso sentence above it, not limited to. All, what does it say here? Yes, include, but are not limited to. You have to read it like that. Yeah. Honourable Khadeni?
Chairperson, again, when we go to the issue of C and D, it really speaks to the issues of the of the scorecard. But the essence here is that you are dealing with this broad-based black economic empowerment. Black must not lose it out. Yeah, we cannot because these issues of the scorecard. When you read from the top going down, you can see that yeah, these things are just like the issue of achieving equitable representation in all our then it deals with these issues of the scorecard.
Yes, and I noticed there that the issues were also, you know, we factored in the position of National Treasury that has come out into this particular one, if you recall. So, Honourable James, I'll give you a last comment before we move on.
Madam Chair, I think you might be right in this, simply because what's going to drive this process is the scorecard. And that's what worries me. And if every one of these elements are direct or indirectly related to the scorecard, my concern might be alleviated by the rereading of this.
Yeah, I think it will be.
Because it does clearly say, but I'm not limited to. Okay.
All right. That qualifies the whole of the, you've got to read it with that. And if we look at Advocate Elder there, he's pondering the situation, I think. Do you not agree? I'm not saying you agree with the, what it's to say, but the principle. Yes.
As we read it, it's not limited to.
No.
So most certainly there can be other factors. Right within that definition. Already to that definition.
Thank you for that clarification. We now want to I've seen the hand. I'm also trying to look at my paper. Right. Do you wish to comment on the same thing on all Macintosh?
I'm not clear where limited to comes in. Is that in the Act or in the Bill?
Let me point it out to you. It's C, you know, and it's line 19, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
All right. So now, we left the code issue alone that they want to us to review, but moving into C, and the A, B, C, D, E, we're all right, and F, we are all right. It was C. D, we're coming out to D. So C, no objection. Right, D. D, by the insertion after the definition of council of the following definitions, but there's no amendment proposed here. That was D. D, line 30, I think, or 32. Line 32, right, and the first commission. No objection. Then E from line 38 or 37. E A B C D. Right. No objection. Page 4, which actually should say then D 1 Roman small Roman 1. Sorry. D, small Roman 1, page 4, D, Roman, small Roman 2,
small Romans 3. And then we're on about line 9, knowingly or knows, when used with respect to a person and in relation to a particular matter, means that the person either A, had actual knowledge of the matter, or B. B, small Roman 1, small Roman 2, small Roman 3. F to the left, by the insertion after the definition of the organ of state of the following definition, referring to premises, etc. G. Now when we get to that, on G, are there any objections? That's up to line 24, on page 4. No objections. Amendment 2 of Act 53, 2003, 2, A, B, C. Any objections? Taking you to line 40. No. Then I look at your amendments here that were proposed. Clause 3. Clause rejected. Clause 3. Are you still of the same opinion? Right. New clause. That the following be a new clause to follow clause 2. Your new clause 3, amendment of section 3 of Act 53, 2003. This is how you're proposing that it reads. 3. Section 3 of Principal Act is hereby amended. Are you all following that? A. By the substitution for paragraph A of the following paragraph. To give effect to its objectives and purposes, and by. Let me get my head around the two ends here. And by the addition. While we got those two M's in there, I'm sure the legal people will assist us there. Yes, thank you, advocate.
This is precisely as the current Act reads, Honourable Chair. You notice the words between the quotation marks are an exact quote from the Act, and the second and merely connects paragraphs A and B of that of the amendment number 1 and a new clause.
So that is in line with the Principal Act, which it may be useful for us to get that Principal Act, which is the next one underneath. So I think it's worthwhile for us all just to check it against the Principal Act. Thank you very much. B, by the addition of the following subsection, this current section becoming subsection 1. So 2, in the event of any conflict between this Act and any other law in force immediately prior to the date of commencement of the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Amendment Act 2013, this Act prevails. If the conflict relates specifically to a matter dealt with in this Act. I think the legal advisors probably did deal with that. They're all nodding. Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I just have a question on that last sentence, where it says, if the conflict specifically relates to a matter dealt with in this Act. And my concern is, does that adequately restrict the trumping or retrospective element That's my question. And I ask it partly because it says, in the other law, in force immediately prior to the date. So, that, I mean, that's a retrospective provision, and then there's a proviso if the conflict specifically relates to a matter dealt with in this Act. My question is, are we confident that that will, in fact, as it were, deal with the concerns that the officials, the lead advisors have had with Trumping?
It is a matter that I think we will ask yourself then, Advocate Young, to deal with, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The matter has been dealt with at the previous meeting by my colleagues, but neither does it matter. Needless to say, this is the so-called Trumping provision. I do not know, Madam Chair, whether you would like to discuss the provision now in any event, irrespective of the fact that we indicated earlier that we're waiting for the consultants to provide to the committee the information of the actual identification of these kinds of provisions in other acts of Parliament by Friday, I think, was the day. If you would like to discuss the provision in any event, we will gladly do so. Maybe if I can just, for the sake of the argument, briefly say the following. Sometimes when we discuss these kind of provisions, it's better to try and illustrate by way of hypothetical example. Let us assume that this honourable committee would adopt the amendment as it stands at the moment. This would more or less be the case. If this amendment act would commence on the 1st of January of 2014. And on that particular date, there's a provision in the Employment Equity Act that is inconsistent or in conflict with a provision in this Amendment Act or in the Principal Act that stands to be amended by this Amendment Act. Then this provision is clear. The provision in the amendment, the BEE Amendment Act, will get precedence and will trump and override the provision in the Employment Equity Act. However, if in June of 2014 Parliament would deem it fit to amend that conflicting provision in the Employment Equity Act and amend it in conflict with the BEE Act, then the provision in the employment, the amended provision in the Employment Equity Act will prevail, take precedence over the provision in the BEE Act. The reason Advocate Smuts explained at the previous meeting, the rationale for this is the following. If this provision would, or this qualification would not be part of this amendment, then the legal consequence would be that in a sense that the hands, the legislative hands of Parliament are tied because of this provision. Then, because almost then in perpetuity, this BEE Act will take precedence over conflicting provisions in other acts of Parliament. Now, clearly, I do not think that is the intention on the part of the committee. If for some reason in future Parliament would deem it appropriate that there should be in another act of Parliament a conflicting provision with the BEE Act, then Parliament should be in a position to do so. I think I've said enough, Madam Chair, maybe for the sake of the discussion. If it stands as it is, that would be the legal consequence.
I think it's very, very clear. This committee of Parliament, we forget that sometimes, there are devolved functions to us. We do not have the right constitutionally to override Parliament's constitutional authority to formulate, develop, and adopt new legislation. And I think this is a constitutional issue, actually, as I see it. We don't have that right. We cannot trump the Constitution. Do we understand that clearly? So that is what that means. But obviously, when this provision is enacted, all legislation, when it is developed, and I know people like the Honourable Salah are very familiar with this, should and must take cognizance of what is already in place and the purpose for that.
and not find itself chopping and changing and chopping. And then you become a kangaroo sort of parliament. You see, hop, hop, hop all over the show. And we're no kangaroo parliament. So we have to recognize that. But I'm glad that we have identified that and may wish to say, well, and ask a question, officially the chair of the subcommittee, well, what? The question may well be, well, what is the point then of making these provisions, you see? These provisions continue to evolve as time goes on, and that is why I think some members on this committee kept on saying legislation is always in the process of amendments. In a way, nothing is, you know, concretized and it can never be changed. We've just seen this now. So there's no need for sunset clauses. Do you see? Oh, yes, I got your attention that time. No sunset clauses. So all I'm saying is we now have just seen that in action. That we will pass this, say, we could pass this in Parliament, but there's the possibility another piece of legislation, in inverted commas, could trump it. In inverted commas. Am I correct, state advocates and the parliamentary? See, you're looking at me now a little bit concerned when I put it that way. But I'm talking about the practicalities. Right, so we are moving on. So what we're saying about this one, it does. There's no need for us to stop it, regardless of what the your lawyers are coming up with. Is this not correct? You have to have a reservation at the end of the table there, African. I don't see you nodding.
If I may, the clause, and I know there were a number of submissions asking for such a provision, and the subcommittee did in fact propose this clause. This clause is an improvement on the one that was publicly gazetted. It's got, to a certain extent, ring fence. However, it remains a contentious or a clause in the sense that it's difficult to see how today, how it would impact on any other law. Take, for instance, the Oceanic court case. In that case, the question was whether the policies of the Minister of Environmental Affairs should trump the codes issued under the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act. And in that instance, the Minister argued that there is no relevant code applicable to fishing. Therefore, the Minister argued that the codes of the policy should apply and not the codes. If this clause were to have been inserted prior to that court case, the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act would have prevailed. But in that instance, the Minister specifically wishes the policies to prevail. So that I'm just giving all the information for you to consider. And
yes, it's important to bring this onto the table for consideration. Honourable Bukhadibi?
Chairperson, we said that this thing was demanded by a lot of stakeholders, what this thing is. But I think that let us await the report. This is going to come from the department, okay, dutifully by Friday. It was that it must have in the committee on Tuesday. So that on the committee it must have on Tuesday. So that we really balance that, because at the end of the day we want to come up with a decision which is good, which is not going to create a confusion. So we'll assess it from there, because I don't see us going anywhere when we are still shooting in the darkness without having some sort of a reference thing. Because my reference might happen, even the report might come in. Imagine that we need a report from somewhere else, but let us wait for that so that you see. But at the end of the day, is that we must be able to explain to the constituencies or to the stakeholders that because of 1, 2, 3, 4, we have to omit it. Or these things which are being raised are going to be converted by only 1, 2, 3, 4. So let us park it for the next time.
Yes. We'll agree to waive the trumping clause. But I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is we wouldn't like to limit policy space at any time. We're already arguing internationally about that, so we better not create the limitations domestically. So we will await that. Now you can see how important they are. One would hope DDGU convey some of the challenges that we have raised in this regard. All right. Chief Director?
Thank you, Chair. I think one of the chair will also agree that the report from the lawyer is going to be very important to assess, but also we also recognize the fact that at this stage we really can't preempt. Yes, we may be nervous about the implication of the provision, but we can't preempt and know for a fact what will be the implication once it's enacted. Therefore, also trying to on the question of side, also lead the department into a challenge where we indicated prior to this honorable committee that over the past year, since 2003, we've had a challenge of different pieces of legislation pronouncing on both basic government. The Department of Trade and Industry is seen as the only custodian of this policy, and where companies and the market has directed that government give us clear one direction in terms of how to apply. We don't have an objection to complying with government policies, but we have a challenge where we have different pieces of legislation government trying to pronounce on the same issue. Also in case the issue of the Oceania was a very profound case in the sense that yes, it was dealing with fisheries and the issue of carbon licenses. But however, the issue was that Oceania as a company adopted the broad-based scorecard in terms of the 7 elements. And they felt that the fisheries department was and did not consider that because they only focused on ownership management. Now, they were saying that you defeated the objectives of what government has put in place because the scorecard was completed in 2007 and this is what government said you will comply with. And then you have another department which limited now the scorecard itself and said, I will only focus on ownership and management. And that is what the OSHA group was discussed with. So I was saying that there are those kind of dynamics and issues that really said that you need to create a seamless, harmonized environment. And I think what was put forth by another colleague, Freedom, was that indeed this provision does not seek to supersede any other in the future. So what is important is that how do we create that conducive environment as now we're going to embark on this new framework in terms of PE. But we will also, as I said, Honourable Chair, really rely on the report that will come from our lawyers, but we must also look at what is the defect that we are trying to cure at the department.
Right, I think that's been helpful in persuading us just to wait a while as well and just see where this takes us. So I hope members are noting the clauses that we do have to come back to, please. That one certainly will be Friday and not the end of today, but Friday. All right, we like to get it, of course, the day before. It's very difficult when we get it on the day. Members, we now move. Thank you very much for that, Advocate Mark. Then we move to Clause 5. Clause 5 is on page 5, line 7. Page 5, line 7. Right. Before we go to your amendments, can we go back to page 4? Yeah, then clause 4, where there were no objections and amendments, you agree clause 4, substitution of section 853-2003 for the following section is hereby substituted for section 8 of the Principal Act. Remuneration and reimbursement of expenses from about line 47 to 51. There was no objection there. All right.
And then we go to the, I'm just following my own here. That takes us to that. So we then go back to our amendments, which are the amendments of clause. On page 5, line 7, clause 5. Amendment here, let's just see, right. And it is to omit and to substitute. I think this is probably the correction, the same sort of technical correction you had before, to keep it in line with the principal act. All right, so that's a technicality. Any objections? No. So we move on then, and we go to, just a minute here, that was on page 5 from line 8 to omit paragraph B. Paragraph B says by the insertion in subsection 1. Can you see that there? To omit paragraph B, the whole of B. You agree? Yes. Can we move to C? And on page 5 again, we do have some issue here, but it notes here that we've got no objections at all. So, then, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I wish to substitute, exceed those, but with the word, the adjective different, the adverb, which are different from those set by the Minister. So the
distinction. Just a minute, you're talking about line 15.
Correct, Madam Chair. So it's line 15. So instead of exceed, have different. That is the sense of. Initially, we were debating whether it should exceed or decrease, but why not just have different?
Let's read that then. If requested to do so, the Minister may by notice in the Gazette may permit organs of state or public entities to specify qualification criteria for procurement and other economic activities which exceed those set by the Minister, which are different to those. I think the whole purpose of that was on the emphasis of increase, of exceed, and that there's no problem of underneath, you know, below. I mean, that was the purpose or the intention here. And when you say different, it can be below or above. Now, you're raising an important issue, which means that the committee must agree to that. So the intention was not to go below, it's only above. Honourable James?
There is a, I mean, the problem we had with this is that it undermines the uniformity of the system and gives the minister discretion. So he can say to ESCOM, look, you can raise the bar here, and for that you get additional brownie points. And public sector companies have more control over what happens in their sectors than private sector companies often. So there were two problems with this. The one is that it undermines uniformity of the system. Why don't we just have a uniform system? And secondly, it gives the minister discretionary power that we think can be abused. Not by this minister, but those are the issues. That's what worries us.
Right. Is there any comment from the ANC? No. You see, when I look at it, you actually, yourself who used the word ESCOM, raised the entity as an example. And I'm looking at this and I say, if requested to do so, the Minister may, by notice in the Gazette, permit organs of state or public entities to specify qualification criteria for procurement. I have a kind of qualification criteria that certain specialised entities may wish to put in order to reduce, you know, from say 1,000 applications to 100, as it were. And there may be a specific necessity to require that these specifications should be put in. for the benefit of ensuring a quality service. By that I'm talking of the scientific, and I'm thinking of the electricity, some of the scientific things, some of the work that Danelle is involved in, and perhaps other entities and not. I'm trying to get my head around that. But of course, the subcommittee, I know data has done a lot deeper. Probably with having grandchildren, you start using all the wrong language, Jake, deeper. Right. You don't recall discussing this in subcommittee on what you're doing?
Your concern with the subcommittee level. I think that there was a general agreement, there was an agreement on that issue. That is, you take it, that's why that sometimes when you look at this thing, what is the purpose of the subcommittee if we're going to come in question everything agreed upon on that aspect? Because there was a clear argument that in certain instances, just like the plaza, when they are dealing with our staff, they can help, they can exceed what the minister must put, now with the bottom line, nothing beyond that. But if in that sector they are able to raise the bar, let them be allowed to that.
Yeah,
exactly. I think we agreed upon that. So if we are going to do it again, we have to refer back again to the subcommittee.
No, but as I say, the subcommittee is
there
to refresh our motions,
to
refresh them, but if there's some timing thing, we don't want to find ourselves going over every single issue that was raised, but perhaps if some members feel very strongly, their parties, I should say, then they are obliged to raise it finally in committee. So there doesn't seem to be broad support for it. I'm looking around. Is there much support for changing, for amending the word exceed? It would appear to have been yourself, perhaps, Honourable McIntosh, you felt quite strongly about it. So perhaps you can concede at this point. Can we agree on six, allowing C6 to stand? That is in line 15. Would appear. Thank you very much, Honourable McIntosh, constructive member of the committee here. C7, a code of good practice remained in effect until amended, replaced, or repealed. There were no amendments by the put forward here by yourself, so that stands. So it would appear then that we can agree. There are no objections then, I take it, to the amendment of Section 9 Act 53-2003, 5, A, B, and C. Right. Can we then move to the amendment of Section 10 of Act 53-2003-6? The following section is hereby substituted for Section 10 of the Principal Act. Status of Codes of Good Practice. It would appear as if that passed muster.
Yeah.
Right. Any objections? No objections. That is then 10.1, A, B, C, D, E, 2, 3. Now we have an amendment of Section 11 of Act 53-2003. 7. Yes, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I don't think we discussed the meaning of effective. Maybe the line is 49.
Yes.
If maybe the department can explain what they understand by effective. I don't think it's in the act.
Line 49.
I don't know if it's a technical term in terms of this.
I must say, I thought myself that when it came to efficient, one was looking at an economic situation when one can have a very efficient service delivery, but it's not effective. Why not? It's only going to my suburb. So, of course, I'm just using that. Not sure what my suburb gets. Right. But effective, yes, Honourable Lewis?
No.
So, effective. I understood it to mean quality, or something along those. Not efficient. You can have something that is efficient and effective, economically sound, effective. It is achieving the purpose for which it is intended. That is what the dictionary definition is. I don't know which dictionary you were using? There were about 7 dictionaries. What did you mean, E.G.?
No, the chair, I think we meant exactly the way you put it, that it suffers and it gives the results like we intended. Yes.
I wonder, Honourable McIntosh, would this suffice as a deal with your concern?
Madam, yes, it's just that effective is a very, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean effective is a very broad kind of term, and I'm not, look, I don't think it's a big issue, but in a sense it's a kind of, how would I put it, apple pie and mother love kind of word, and I mean, the suggestion is that they are ineffective black owned and managed enterprises. Now, I can't believe that's true. They must all be effective. So, what does it mean? So, why don't they just take it out? I mean, I don't understand. I think effective has to have some content.
Well, there are, I think, Honourable Kazemi to respond here.
Chairperson, there can be enterprises which are not, which are not effective, whereby the creeping element of fronting might be there. That will not be effective. Whatever. So, I think it is a
I mean, even if it wasn't fronting, you have people who run effective enterprises and those who don't, and they're not fronting. They just are better at the job, at whatever they're doing. That is why you get everyone R1,000 and who makes more money, the other one goes bankrupt. Because certain people operate differently. We would like to support those who operate effectively. I think the incentive scheme, if you're going to have an incentive scheme, Honourable McIntosh, and everything is black owned and managed enterprises, 8%, are you going to give everyone an incentive or those that are more effective? You see, it's a business principle, really. Thanks. Can we agree then? Right? And then we move on to page 6, and you're looking at an amendment.
Thank you. Thank you.
are going to be starting in a few seconds. Track, as it were. Yes, DG.
Thanks, sir. It's the DG. By the way, yeah, sir. I'm sorry to take you back. Just few paragraphs. The intentions of amending the act and also amending the code is to ensure that there is no one either the. They are talking about the state organ or they're talking about private enterprise. There is no one who's performing below the code. So the codes are the minimum. Okay? Yes. But then there's been a small oversight, Chair. And this is related, I think, to the issue of the trampling. Because by us introducing the trampling provision, we are trying to say you can only do more than what the codes are saying. But then if you are a state organ, and because you know your environment, and you want to do more, then you can apply to the minister and say, please, you know, I know his environment very well. The guys can do more than what we could say. That means that, I think that's the issue, and it's going to be concerned by our lawyers. But then there is a paragraph here, and this is on page 5, line 1, line 23, page 5, line 23, when we are talking about the status of the code, section 10.1, are you there, Chair? Yeah.
Are we all here?
It reads like, every organ of state and public entity must take into account and as far as is reasonably possible, apply any relevant code of good practice issued in terms of this act. Chair, we debated this clause at length within the PTI, and from what the public was saying, we thought it would be good and it will remove a contradiction if we take away the as far as is reasonably possible. Because that sentence would contradict the trumping provision. Because an organ of state can always reason that he is not the truth. Yes. So I think we suggested that as far as the reasonable possible must be taken or must be deleted. So that this now is in line with the trumping provision. We have discussed with the lawyers, I think they also agree.
Now, it's not going to train the industry through the EDEG support. It's putting this forward now, 5. Clearly, it perhaps was overlooked by the subcommittee, I think, perhaps because I'm not sure everyone sees X with the subcommittee. May not have arisen at the time. Am I right, Honourable Kajimi? No. But you have to take account of it in the sense that if we give people the opportunity to get out of something, here's the minimum. You can apply to anything, minimum wages, minimum whatever, and then we say, well, okay, it could be okay if it's not reasonably possible. And you still want your milk, you needn't supply it. It could create an escape clause. And yet at the same time, members of the committee are asking for the department to consider a trumping clause. You know, the two just don't go together. Either you're going to trump, or you'll be fighting this in court endlessly on litigation. And we really would like to avoid court battles that take up the state expenditure. So let me hear, this has just arisen. So I would like to hear all parties' comments on the matter. Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, this could be court battles. If we're talking about state procurements, right, and essentially what the state is saying is whites must not apply for business if they're under 20 million or 10 million turnover. And but if they do want to, they must find a black partner. Now, my concern is that one needs to take into account as far as reasonably possible. Let's take the example I used beforehand, the boilers at the Vryheid Hospital. Now, it's not a big job. You don't have a huge multi-million rand company, but the boilers at the Vryheid Hospital, the Escort Hospital, and the Ladysmith and Dundee Hospitals are managed and maintained by a company for 30 years, which is white-owned. Now, their turnover has expanded or increased. Now they must bring in a black, an Indian or a coloured or a Chinese or in KwaZulu-Natal a Zulu guy involved in the company. Now it may not be in the interests of the health department of KwaZulu-Natal to have boilers breaking down. And they might say, well look, it's not a big deal, boilers are too important, we're going to carry on with the company called Henderson, Hafaji, or Henderson and Fanamerva, and that's the way. And I just think we need to be realistic. Look, I know that if we're really committed to social engineering in our economy, well, obviously I would be overruled. But I think I can't see a problem with as far as reasonably possible.
I'm hearing what you say, but then I'm thinking of something we tackled earlier when we said it need not be limited to. It did seem to indicate to me that notwithstanding the codes, it is not limited to, that you've got minimum compliance, but that it would not be limited to that C, I think it was, just looking at that advocate's time. Remember, we just tackled that.
Sorry, Madam Chair, that was on page 3, and it was in line 19, yes. Page 3. But with respect, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry if you would allow me, just very, very briefly, to interrupt the issue, and I apologize for having been out of the chamber for a while, but I think I caught up with the issue that has been raised by the DDG. And clearly, Madam Chair, these words are problematic. What is the legal consequence of those words as far as is reasonably possible? You mentioned just a while ago the word escape clause. Yes, indeed. This is almost a statutory defense for not being able, based on any reasonable ground, for not applying the measure that we find in these laws. So I'm glad to hear that the matter is being discussed. I would not like to advance at this point any specific possible amendment or propose with respect to possible amendment, but clearly it is an issue to be discussed. If an organ of state or entity can in any circumstance just show one cogent or reasonable ground why they cannot, for practical purposes, adhere to these measures, those words provide them with a statutory defense for non-application.
I wonder if members all got that. Honourable James?
Chair, you, I mean, this is a voluntary system insofar as if you were a business and you wanted to business with the government, then you have to comply. But you can also do business without dealing with government and you don't comply. So it is voluntary to that extent, very different to Malaysia, where in the past it simply didn't allow it. So I actually agree that every organ of state and public entity must take into account, and I won't be unhappy with the deletion of that that section of it.
Right, but are we dealing with that section we were on just at that time, which was actually on page, where are we? No, the one which was raised by Honourable McIntosh. No, 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 not that. The one we just referred to now.
That's on page 5.
Yes, it is page 5.
And a line 23. Mm. 10-1.
Yeah, I think it was that one where you sort of went back. Now, we've heard the response from DTI to say, Honourable James, you saying you agree, let's leave it. Honourable Khadebi, do you have anything to say?
I didn't agree to leave it. I said I wouldn't be happy if it was taken out.
Yes, but that, I mean, to leave it as is. Yes, not to have it deleted. Is that what you did?
I would agree to delete it.
You wish to have it deleted.
That's the proposal from the DDB, and I would support that.
All right, Chairperson, before we can agree on it, let's say we are dealing with ESCOM next. Nuclear energy field program, which is unique. The skills and all those things are abroad. Will we still hold ESCOM around those issues when we don't have the skills and the capacity within the country? What effect will it have on that project? Because we will have to consider that scenario. Yeah, you just like you said, the environment. You know, the UK engineers who deal, actually, that village was destroyed after the canning of the nuclear, so what's going to happen with ESCOM? They say, now starting a nuclear field environment, they are not skilled, they cannot comply, they have to get only companies from abroad who are dealing with this, who are for that. Will this not be able to protect them? Or has it put something whereby if they're suggesting the minister must provide an exemption for that? So this can go now, it goes back to the other one, whereby we said this one is the minimum. But here, even with the minimum, we should be having here. But there are no skills to meet that minimum. But I thought that this one would be able to have an escape route for those, for such companies which are going to deal with that.
I think we have to. I'm going to take Advocate Albert's hands as well, Honourable Albert. We can't afford to shoot ourselves in the foot here. We must make sure whatever we take forward into the House to be adopted, we've got the intention, but what the intention is not designed to do is to cripple the economy. And we, you know, that has to be balanced. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Honourable Khadebe. We have to be realistic in terms of our skills base in South Africa, and we also have to be realistic about emergency situations. Say, for instance, the lift here in Parliament was broken for a while. The only service provider available at that time to have it fixed expediently is a white firm. Should we just wait and wait until we get an appropriate black firm? So there are exceptions to the rule, and there must be flexibility for that. Thank you.
All right. Honourable McIntosh, and I think we've got a pause at the moment on this issue. Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, my concern is practicalities. The reality is that at this moment in South Africa, there's a government and they have a strong majority. They're running basically, apart from the Western Cape, and one or two, they run what we would call all the organs of state and public entities. All right. Now, This forces them to take it into account. And for example, I don't see that your public entities in your states and other things are going to easily not support. support the laws that their own government and party have introduced. They would support black economic empowerment. But you could have a case in the Western Cape where Honourable James's party is in government, and they say, but we think it's reasonably possible, and they could make a case for it to do something different. But the effect would be that they would have no choice, the Western Cape government. So I just think, just on practicality, I agree with Honourable Khadir, and I think the example of the lifts, and those of us who live in Mark's building are really conscious of our lifts. Not that I think we've got lots of good lift companies in South Africa. But the point is, Madam Chair, I just think the state and the government and the ANC and so on would, I mean, they would apply these rules. To now make it exclude as far as is reasonably possible is, I think, tying them very, very strongly indeed. And I would sympathise, Madam Chair, with Honourable Khadeb and Honourable Albert, that we rather leave this here, because it will be an exception, Madam Chair. I'm sure it will be a complete exception. And the nuclear and the lifts are good examples.
All right, let's have the Honourable James, because this is a very important point. There's no way we are going to put halt on our infrastructure. Let's just get this straight. Honourable James.
Chair, I don't have a strong feeling about this. Let me say that the relevant code of good practice that issued in terms of the act is the scorecard. We will get to the scorecard. We have some proposals about making that scorecard a flexible instrument that deals with ownership, that deals with control, that deals with employment equity, that deals with training, education, development, and social philanthropy, and so on and so forth. So make that point firstly. And secondly, what is important to realize is that when it comes to putting that scorecard together, for foreign firms, we have something called equity equivalence that's built into the scorecard. So if you need some specialist nuclear agency from France to supply, it's an equity equivalent that's supplied. So, I mean, I take the point about not tying everybody's hands and what have you, but this is quite a sophisticated system that's being put together here. This is one element of it. My only fear is that if you give people a tough clause, they will die out. I mean, that's what will happen. And so we have to find some balance of not paralyzing the state and not giving people a duck out clause. And I don't see here. Maybe this is an issue we should return to and not settle it here.
Yeah, I just don't think we have resolved it. That's the point. Honourable Elvis, can you say the final word, please?
Madam Chair, I think in terms of Honourable Banks' proposal, I think we must park this, because if their ideas later on in terms of what should be in the codes doesn't come to fruition, then they could be bound in as well in a code that's not likable for themselves. So we first must deal then with the code and then come back to the provision.
I don't think we were saying we were going to deal with the codes per se, but let me not misinterpret what you have said, Honourable Albert. Honourable Stevie, I want you to simply park us now, but...
I want to point out that let the department please go and look at that thoroughly, so that when you come back, think about it. As I said initially, this share gap, we don't have that large rule of share in the country. It's not here. But it can make a huge difference. That thing has to be in budget, like it or not. So let them go and look at that thoroughly, or where it's addressed on the regulation, so that this exemption is tied, is tied in the regulation level.
Yeah, I want all the implications. There's not going to be any shooting from the hip here. We want all the implications sorted out. And with due respect, Chief Director, I think that's exactly what you're going to have to do. Test it with every scenario that is there. When you come back to the committee on Thursday afternoon, we're having another committee meeting because we... there are certain issues we have to try and resolve this week. At least discuss it among yourselves and the lawyers here as well, and put some examples on the table. In this scenario, we're dealing with issues right now where we don't have sufficient. As we talk, the economy is not transformed.
January the 14th. You know, we're not intended here. We're here to break down the economy. We're intended to transform it in a constructive manner. So I want us to look at this very, very carefully here. We've heard the point made by Honourable Kadebe, Honourable James, Honourable Elvis and McIntosh. All of them have relevance. All of them. All of them. Although I don't want to keep on going back to the fact that whites will not be able to have jobs and contracts with government. Because I think the point is quite clear. It is not limited to this group here. Not limited. Okay? So let us get beyond that. And I have been studying all your articles, Honourable McIntosh, and making space for them among the 60-odd emails I get daily. So that says a lot for me and my time. So please, I am aware of your argument, and I think you put it very, very succinctly. Thank you, Honourable McIntosh. But my whip is, as everyone knows, on the Ethics Committee, and that is one of the few committees that takes precedence over this committee. So you are excused. We will be closing down on the committee shortly, which is why we have to bring in Thursday. Some of us are involved with the discussions with the European President, the President of the European Union as well. But I would hope that we can continue for at least another 15 to 20 minutes, all right? Clause, well, we went back, if you recall, do you remember, we went back. Now, we were on just getting this page 6, do you remember, when we went for tea? And we still have to do it clause by clause, of course, but I see now we are on clause on page 6, line 6. Now, 8, that's about line 2 or 3. The following sections are hereby inserted in the Principal Act, Article 13. Cancellation of contract or authorization. Knowingly. And 13A, we then had on page 6, line 6, after information to insert knowingly. Are there any objections? No. And then, of course, the issue remains then as is, which is the minister in conceal the underlining, which was there before as well, right up until 9. Fine. We then move to the establishment and status of Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Commission. Is it the commission or are there several commissions? There's one commission, huh? Of the 13B, the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Commission, is hereby established as a trading entity within the administration of the department. Department somewhere must have had a decision to effect that department being DTI. Was that earlier captured earlier? I'm just looking at the space legal people. Right, so that's fine. That's on page 6, so we can move beyond that. 13B, the whole of that is put in. Do we accept that 13B? Any objections to 13B? No. Appointment of commissioner. 13C, the minister must appoint. Sorry. The minister must, A, in consultation with the relevant portfolio committee of parliament, appoint a person with suitable qualifications and experience as commissioner for a term of office of not more than 5 years. Right? B, the minister must, for the purposes of paragraph A, provide the portfolio committee with small Roman 1, particulars of at least three possible candidates, and Roman 2, the name of his or her preferred candidate as the reasons for the preference. Sorry about that. So, if you look at your clause 8 amendment, it says after two, on page 6, line 32, omit subsection 1 and substitute it with all of what we have just read, which ends with the word preference. Are there any objections to that? No. Then your amendment 3, just making sure we're not missing the out on anything, that was 32, 13C. 1. The emitter must appoint, right? That took us to there, 1336. One additional term on. Page 6 in line 36, after office, to insert for one additional term of office. To insert. I raised this issue last time. Can that be a consecutive term of office? Always, or only in the first instance? So that was the question I raised. So everyone seems happy, no objections. Right. Page 7. So now we'll go back to the main, the Amendment Act, appointment of a commissioner. We've done that. 36 line, 36, 3. 3A, 3B, 3C, 4, which is line 45, 5, 6, line 50. Of serious, the minister may remove the commissioner from office on account of serious misconduct, permanent incapacity, engaging in any activity that may undermine the integrity or standing of the commission, or D, any other legitimate ground that justifies the removal of the commissioner. Right. At 55, line 55 there. And then we go to page 7. So there were no objections there. We go to page 7. Appointment of the deputy commissioner and staff of commission. 13D. I've got a cross here on 9. Why would I put a cross? 13D. We haven't made any. One, the commissioner, two, refers to 13C, 2, 4, 5, and 6, applied to the deputy commissioner, read with such changes as required by the context, 3A, B, 4, the commissioner may, A, appoint staff, etc., or contact with other persons, B, in consultation with the Minister and the Minister of Finance, determine the remuneration of allowances, benefits and other terms as a condition of appointment of each member of staff. That took you to line 18. No objections. Right. We then begin to come to some of your amendments. Finances of the Commission. 13E1. The Commission is financed from A. No problem there. 21 though. Line 21, after money to assert lawfully. That is line 21B. Do you see that there?
Yeah.
To assert lawfully. Turning the page here. On page 7, from line 22 to omit subsection 2. The whole of subsection 2 is deleted, omitted. On page 7, after you retain 3, the Auditor General must audit the Commission's financial records every year, annually. Right. So, no objections then. Functions of Commission. Of the Commission 13F. Your First Amendment comes in at line 51, much further down. But 13F1, the functions of the Commission are A, B, C, D, E, F, G. H, is line 50, this gives us 51, it says here, to exercise such other powers which are not in conflict with this act as, and they want to assert the following subsection of 51. A new, a complaint contemplated in subsection 1 C and D must be. You want an insertion, not a substitution, I hope you see that. A, in the prescribed form and B, substantiated by evidence, justifying an investigation by the commission. So that was an insertion. It doesn't replace what is in 2K. All right? Honourable James, you...
I just wanted to say that is known as the anti-witch hunt clause.
Unlike some of our compatriots, you're not calling it the James clause. Right. We then move on to... yes, a DG.
Sorry, Chair. Didn't you omit an amendment on line 35?
35?
Yeah.
Let me just see. That is page 7, line 22. And I've only got a line 51. These are the amendments from the subcommittee. Special investigating unit established under the special investigation. Commissioners and Special Tribunals Act 1996, Act Number 74 of 1996, to perform any of the Commission's duties and functions under this Act. That is a very important provision that you should study and have a clear understanding of what you're agreeing to. No objections, I see. We then go on the point of just having to leave, but page 4 of your amendments here, we then look at on page 8 from line 28, which is still a little bit.
Madam Chair, I wonder if I could just ask the DDG a question on 4. On you're right on the notwithstanding, but maybe he could look at it. It's a provision that's subject to the approval of the minister, but it's actually just giving the approval to the minister, and the commissioner can effectively almost delegate everything to anybody, provided the minister has approved. Now, I don't know whether the DDG or the department thinks there is a process where one shouldn't just say subject to including that in his annual report or something, because you know, he and the minister could have a cozier relationship to delegate something to somebody, and it's actually a very wide power, Madam Chair, and it's really just the commissioner and the minister doing their own thing together.
Well, I don't think it's quite that cozy, but if you want to take this further in a discussion, we'll do that tomorrow. Hello?
Yeah, fine,
no, not tomorrow. I forgot that's our debate, yes. On Thursday. You remember, we're not meeting tomorrow, are we? No. Okay. So what we're going to do now, we're at the point here where we just want to get to your clause where you would change when I would need to leave, and we agreed that we would just adjourn the meeting at that point, possibly. Reporting 3G1. That hasn't been raised, but certain issues afterwards, all spheres. We come to 28, 25, and 16, 28, which is number 2. So, one, there are there any objections?
Madam Chair?
1, 35G1. Yes, Honourable McIntosh?
Sorry, on 2. On
2, not 1.
No, this is it. Not there yet. Just finished the 1. Any objections? No. Right, now we're on 2, which, of course, has got some amendments. I'm just looking here. On page 8 from line 28 to omit subsection 2 and to substitute it with what you see on your amendments. Did you wish to speak before, Honourable
Madam Chair, now I support what's here. My real concern in terms of I'm thinking particularly of the point that Honourable James mentioned from his experience as a director of Sunlum, is that there is a term on the stock exchange called public float or free float, because there's some companies on the stock exchange which don't trade. They're not tradable very much. I'll take an example of a big company in my hometown, Masonite. Masonite is very tightly held. So it isn't, as it were, a public float. It isn't a free float. Now, my concern is that if, and the stock exchange is a big market, it's like my or Epping Market, provided there's an open trading of companies on the market, then doesn't really want to burden them with this kind of legislation. And the way you normally use it, Madam Chair, is you talk about a public float or a free float on a company. So if a company, for example, is 60% or more traded openly, anybody, the pension funds buy them, then I just think that the guys you want to get to be compliant are the companies where 80% of the shares are held by a small group, as it were. They're not then public float. They're not free float. And because if they're free float, everybody's buying. So my something to think about is that all companies listed in the term must provide the listed in the stock exchange which have a free float of less than 60%. must provide to the Commission in such manner as may be prescribed. So it means the companies are free to enterprise.
You mean, Honourable Mackintosh, I understand what you're saying, but I don't entirely agree. Let me take some of the hand, Honourable Hilders.
Yeah, I think Honourable Mackintosh misunderstands the clause. This has got nothing to do with who buys the shares. This has got to do with the company themselves and how they comply with BEE in the way that they operate daily.
Now, thank you very much, Honourable Hilders. You're on top of it. I wondered where you were, you know, sort of neatly, just because you were so quiet. Honourable James?
The intention from the subcommittee side for changing this is to restrict the reporting to BEE compliance.
Yeah.
Because in the original law, as you see, it says ask for any other information.
Yeah.
And my point being on Sunlam is once you give, you know, they must report whatever, and the red ties and done, cost money and so on. The purpose is simply to restrict it to complying, information compliant BEE. That's.
And I think there we are. Is that clarified, as the Honourable Mackintosh?
Madam, it's not something I feel strongly about. It's just that I just think the stock exchange should be free to trade as much as possible.
You mean they are free to trade, right? So it's not restricting them. Honourable James and Honourable Hill Lewis?
Just one question of technicality, I suppose, semantics. There aren't, it's not every entity listed on the stock exchange is a public company. There are also many trusts listed on the stock exchange. Would they be exempt from this clause?
Now, I am going to put that to the lawyers to come back on Thursday with for us to discuss that. So we're on this point. Are we all on the same page? We are going to have a meeting on Thursday afternoon after the House sitting for two hours, I understand, right? And for those who don't have transport or the buses are problematic, the secretary will have to deal with that. I'm not trying to cut the meeting short per se, it's just that I have a commitment which the speaker has called me to, so unfortunately I must go. Members, as you know, our report is on the ATC, the Report of Trade and Industry, and I certainly want to wish everyone well in the debate and simply to say thank you for contributing as within the committee effectively and constructively in this manner as you did, and as a result of that you have a committee report that you are able to take into account in the debate, plus of course everything else that is linked to the debate. I wish you well. I'll see you in the house tomorrow.